Hello, in this audio snippet, we would like to finish out some thoughts from the previous recording. We tried to explain a series of things related to 3 days, June 6th through June 8th, we were able, I believe, to share most of what we wanted to share, but there were still some things that were left unsaid that or that needed to be cleared up, and the intent of this audio snippet is to fill out those missing little details. First of all, I would like to mention something that happened the very next day after the recording. I strongly believe it's a confirmation of everything that we were saying about those 3 days. And we were talking about June 6th through June 8th of 2023, happened a few days, not too many days from the time of this recording. And so we shared our thoughts on June 10th, or around June 10th, and on the next day, June 11th, there was this big story about a highway collapse in Philadelphia. And so I'd like to first mention some details about that incident. And I'm going to read, I hate to do this, but I'm going to read from NBCnews.com. Here they wrote, Interstate 95, the main roadway between the East Coast, two largest cities, New York City and Philadelphia, will be closed for months after a tanker fire caused a section to collapse, Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro said Sunday. And then it says, an elevated section of northbound lanes in northeast Philadelphia collapsed, trapping the tanker truck and whoever was inside beneath 500 tons of concrete, steel, and rubble at about 6:20 a.m. on Sunday. That was June 11th. Then it says, Shapiro, who was the Pennsylvania governor, apparently, called the scene a quote, a remarkable remarkably devastating sight, unquote. Then it says here, corresponding elevated southbound lanes were found to lack structural integrity. And this is important, prompting closure of the entire freeway, he said. Then it mentions no deaths or injuries were reported, but first responders had yet to get to the tanker truck or any possible occupants, officials said. The fire was still smoldering, but otherwise under control, they said. This story was about this highway, this explosion, apparently some sort of a truck that that was transporting petrol, I'm not sure, or some flammable substance caught fire, and the fire was so intense that it created a structural collapse, and I'm seeing pictures of it. I mean, literally, it was like this bridge structure just fell down. One part of it, as if someone had just sawn it off, and it's pretty impressive. And when I heard about this, it struck me at many levels. First of all, having grown up in Baltimore and living more or less on the northeast corridor of the country, because with my father we would travel once a month to New York and back, and also having lived in New York briefly at the beginning before moving to Baltimore. I-95 has always been kind of like something that everybody knows about, at least in this part, in these parts of the world. So it was interesting to me that there was such a drastic event happening on this highway, I-95. And by the way, in 1983, the last time, and probably the last time ever, that the Baltimore Orioles won the World Series, they played against the Philadelphia Phillies. And that World Series was called by many people the I-95 series because it was between two cities connected by this I-95 highway, which happens to go from Florida all the way up to the border with Canada, if I'm not mistaken. So it's a pretty important highway. And so, so one thing that caught my attention as I was reading this story was this tweet that was added inside the article. And I'm going to read the tweet. It's from Philadelphia OEM. Not sure what that's about, but that's the name of the user and the Twitter user. And the tweet says, "All lanes of I-95 closed in both directions between Woodhaven and Aramingo exits due to fire slash road collapse. Other streets closed for further response. Avoid area, plan and seek alternative travel routes." And I'm trying to read something else here, but it says here there were 8,500 gallons of product in the tanker. Yes, that's Shapiro, the governor, I guess, said the tanker was carrying some kind of petroleum product. There were 8,500 gallons of product in the tanker. That's very significant to me, the number 85, a Coast Guard spokesperson said. The Coast Guard sent a boat to the scene to examine the impact on the water, but it seems no gasoline has made it to the Delaware River. There was some sheening, an iridescent appearance on the surface of the water, but it appeared confined to a nearby cove, the spokesperson said. What caught my attention about the tweet, it mentioned two places, Woodhaven and Aramingo. The Woodhaven exit and the Aramingo exit, and I'm not, familiar with that area. To be frank, I'd never heard the name Aramingo, but it intrigued me why those two exits were kind of like the boundaries of what was closed, and it as I looked up. Aramingo, it all came together. Turns out, when I did a search on Aramingo, turns out that it's a place in Pennsylvania. There's a Wikipedia page titled Aramingo Borough, Pennsylvania. So I'm just going to read from that from that post on Wikipedia. It says Aramingo Borough is a defunct, and that's a very important defunct. Borough, in other words, it doesn't exist anymore, that was located in Philadelphia County, Pennsylvania, United States. The borough ceased to exist and was incorporated into the city of Philadelphia following the passage of the Act of Consolidation of 1854. And then as I read down, it says, because my the reason why I landed on this page was that I was looking for the meaning of the word Aramingo. It's like, what does that mean? So it says here, the name is an abbreviation, an alteration from the Native American name of the stream adjacent, called by the Swedes and English, Gunner's Run. And the original name was, I don't know how to pronounce this, was Tumanaraming, meaning wolf walk, wolf as in the animal, wolf walk. By cutting off a portion of the beginning and omitting two letters in the center and adding an O, the word Aramingo was coined. I'm not sure about why they mentioned omitting two letters. I guess you can kind of arrive at Aramingo in two different ways from this original name. But to me, the easiest way to see it is it's Tuman Araming. So if you take out the Tuman, it becomes Araming. So you just add the O to fill it out, and it becomes Aramingo. That's like the straightforward way that I see of getting to the current name. But the interesting, Tuman Araming means a wolf walk. And this all began to make sense because Woodhaven is a haven. That's how, when I read the word Woodhaven, it immediately rang a bell as if to say haven for wood. In other words, and wood is a very temporary material, building material. You know, if you want to make something more solid, you make it out of concrete. Like the Roman aqueducts would not be with us today if they had been made of wood. At least I don't think so. I don't think they would have survived, all the centuries that they have. Same with the so-called Great Wall of China. If it had been made out of wood, I don't think it would be standing today. So wood is a very popular building product material, but it has a very like temporary quality to it. If you want to make something permanent, you have to use something else, like something that will last and be permanent. Except unless you're building a small structure or an informal structure, then wood seems acceptable. So, why are we in America where we are right now? Because, as we've said before, conservatives have tried to make something that was of a very temporary nature permanent. They have idealized something that was very imperfect and kind of, and I say this in a very qualified way, something that was, quote, okay for the time and in our understanding. But we have conservatives have made it into the ideal paradigm, into the perfect solution. So the founding of this country and the structures that were put in place at the founding were are not seen as something that was put in place so that we can then get started as a country, and then as we grow, reach the real destination or the real structures that we had to reach. They became the permanent solution. This is it. This is the final answer. This is perfection. And it's trying to eternalize the temporary. And so America became a haven for wood, a haven for the temporal, where the temporal can supposedly feel safe from termination, because temporary things come to an end by definition. And it's as if conservatives have been taking all this wood, all this temporary stuff that's supposed to be burned and replaced with something permanent, and trying to give it a safe haven. And that's why we are collapsing. And then that's why the fire is coming to produce the destruction of these temporary structures that we have refused to take down. And because we refuse to take them down, we are being taken down with them. Because the idea was to have them taken down, but with us outside of those structures, our hearts outside of those structures, so that they can be taken down and replaced. But because America has, as a people, have as a people decided we're going to keep these structures, then America's going down with it, with those structures. So Woodhaven, that's what that means. And then Aramingo, as we mentioned a moment ago, means wolf walk. So that means that because we became a haven for wood for the temporary, and we refused to let it go, to let go of that, this has allowed the wolf to walk around, to roam around freely, and unleash its destruction. And that's why liberals are running rampant and destroying the country, because conservatives have been have turned this country into a haven for wood, for temporary things, and they have tried to give them an eternal ideal nature that those things that wood doesn't have. So the wolf has been walking around freely and roaming about and doing all of its destruction. And to me, the word Aramingo also has this weird quality of seeming like the word amigo in Spanish, which means friend. So it's a wolf that has this friendly quality to it, but it's still a wolf, and it will still kill you and devour you. And to me, that's almost an exact description of Democrats. They claim to be your amigo. They claim to be fighting for you, to be your friends, your allies, those who come with tolerance and understanding and love and all this nonsense, but they turn out to be wolves. They are more fascist than the people that they accuse of being fascist. They are if you don't agree with them, they will come like a wolf and charge at you and destroy you and devour you. And they will smear you, ostracize you, and do everything to destroy your life. So they claim to be amigos, but they are they become your enemy the moment you do not completely agree with their agenda and their distorted understanding of the world. You have to be like them, or else they will destroy you. So that's the message in that, those two X's. Because we have become a haven for wood, the conservatives have turned America into this wood haven, then that has opened the door for the wolf to walk around freely amongst us and unleash its destruction. And it does it with a friendly name, even though it is very unfriendly on the inside, like a wolf in sheep's clothing. So to me, that's significant. And what caught my attention when I read this story on June 11th, it made it even more significant. Because when I heard it, it immediately reminded me immediately of something I had been sharing on June 8th with someone. I had mentioned that May 24th and June 8th were very peculiar days personally, because in those 2 days, events that I would have never, or activities or whatever you want to call them, that I would have never have expected to be involved in, especially now with the current times and seasons in the country. I would have never expected to be in that in those situations, you could say. And somehow I ended up being in two such situations within a 15 day span. And on that June 8th, I was speaking to a person who had just been in Philadelphia. And I was speaking, and for some reason, I was sharing about a bridge collapse. And it was in the context of June 29th, 2003, which is the date that Latin America died. So just as America is about to die, Latin America died on June 29th, 2003. And if you go back and look through the history of Latin America, You may not, you know, find a book that says June 29th is the day, you know, Latin America died, but if you do a comparison of before and after that date, you will see how things have shifted in Latin America drastically from this period of democratization and economic prosperity, capitalism flourishing to a certain extent, and people having freedom to vote and living in these relatively free government systems. After that date, something began to happen, and the violence and the crime began to just skyrocket. And then many countries in Latin America turned very left wing, and then there were loss of freedom. Then there was a lot of economic poverty that came, you know, economic collapse and so forth. And so this period, this a golden age that started around in the mid-80s, kind of reached its peak and its end on June 29th, 2003. And ever since then, it's been hell on earth. There is no future. There's no hope. Latin America is a dead region. And that's why they're all flooding now, by the millions, literally into the U.S., even though the U.S. is now on the verge of collapsing itself. And I was sharing that with this person who had just been in Philadelphia, that, and I was in New York at the time, that on that day, I remember it was like a confirmation. As I was becoming aware that Latin America was dead, I found out that a bridge, a sort of like a bridge structure, I don't know how to describe it, but it's kind of a mixture of a bridge and an overpass kind of thing, collapsed, like I would say not more than a mile from where I was that day when I got this realization. There was that, and what happened was there was an earthquake. You know, it didn't, you know, kill thousands of people or whatever, but there was a strong earthquake that day. As I was meditating on and asking, is Latin America dead? A strong earthquake shook the place. And the earthquake was so strong that it damaged this bridge, or overpass kind of thing, and it left it very weak, structurally very unsafe, and they had to close that overpass bridge thing for a while. I forget how long it was, but to me that was a clear indication that the bridge in Latin America, the bridge to prosperity, to freedom, to life was gone. Like enough, as if to say enough, you're done. And so I was kind of describing all of this on June 8th, and then 3 days later, this happens in Philadelphia, and this thing that this structure that became damaged on June 29th, 2003 was like a bridge. It was like it was connecting two roads. One was at a lower level, you could say, and the other road, which was perpendicular to it, was at a higher level. So this bridge would kind of elevate, you know, as you were going, you know, by car on down this road, then you would reach this bridge overpass structure, and you start rising along it. Then it would turn right and into the other road, that was at a higher elevation. And this highway thing, I was seeing the stories about it, and they kept calling it a bridge, and some would call it overpass and so forth. So it kind of evoked the same thoughts of it being like a similar type of structure. So it was like confirmation that yes, these things we've been saying about June 6th through June 8th are real. There's a reality to it, and was confirmed by what this thing that happened on June 11th, 3 days later. So we were talking about the significance of these 3 days, and then 3 days later, this thing collapses. And it was such a precise thing that it, you know, it the exits between Woodhaven and Nerramingo were closed. And as we just tried to indicate, there's a significance to those two exits having been closed. And also, it happened in Philadelphia, which, as we all know, is the place where the Constitutional Convention of 1787 was held. And it was held between the 25th of May and September, the 17th of September. So the current Constitution, which we criticize all the time in these audio recordings, was drafted in Philadelphia. And this happened in Philadelphia. It's a way of kind of symbolizing, hey, the foundational structure, the Woodhaven, you know, this wood, this foundational structure that we have, that was produced in Philadelphia, it's done, baby. It's done. And this tanker with 8,500 gallons of some petroleum substance just burst into fire. And destroyed this bridge. And Philadelphia, you know, being the birthplace of the Constitution, and New York, which was supposed to be the birthplace of the revival of the country, you know, this bridge connecting these two, or this highway connecting these two cities, was interrupted, as if to say, you know, there will be no revival of the country. Because you're sticking to these faulty foundations, these temporal foundations that, yeah, they were acceptable when we were young and stupid, but now that we have had 250 years to mature, 200 and I forget how many, yeah, we're going on 200, I think we've gone past 250, yes. So we've been around as a country, at least if you start counting from 1776, we've been around for more than 250 years. If you start counting from 1789, we haven't gotten there quite yet. But the thing is that we've been around for more than 200 years, and we're still holding on to these wooden structures. And that just brought to my mind, you know, the fire of London in 1666. That big fire that destroyed a whole bunch of places, destroyed a lot of wood. But I think that if I'm not mistaken, that fire was in a way a blessing in disguise because it allowed London to be regenerated in a sense, to become a better, more livable city. But in the case of America, it's a destruction that will have no regeneration because we have decided we don't want the regeneration. At least as a people, we have unfortunately made that decision. So I wanted to share about that incident. And I guess I would like to share about another thing that I ran into by quote accident, another story that seems to confirm what we've been saying about these 3 days and so forth. But before that, I would like to go ahead and clarify or add to some of the thoughts that we had shared in the previous audio recording. So we talked about June 6th, June 7th, and June 8th. And June 6th in the context of D-Day, June 7th in the context of all this smoke that failed. Oh, and there was a fire, wood burning in Canada that led to the smoke that filled the Northeast and, you know, New York in particular, you know, being filled with the air was full of this smoke that made everything yellow and very kind of apocalyptic. And then we talked about June 8th in the context of the death of Pat Robertson and also the indictment of Trump and on that same day. So on June 6th, what we wanted to clarify or add regarding June 6th was that we were saying that Eastern Europe was taken by the Soviet Union because FDR was a commie, a communist at heart. He never said it because it would have been political suicide for him to go out and say, "Hey, I'm a committed socialist." Socialist at the by that I mean someone who is really, really socialist, philosophically socialist, who is like one step away from becoming or embracing communism. Let's put it that way. So that's FDR, polio boy, was a communist at heart, or a philosophical socialist at heart. And what we were saying is that that he refused to act, and June 6th was the day when America finally decided to act and invade Europe and attack the Nazis head on, and that should have been done so much earlier. We needed to set up a quick base in Africa, and from Africa launch into Italy, and it took us forever to do that one step. And once we did Operation Sicily, we talked about Operation Torch. Operation Torch was boom, a few days, and boom, we had a foothold in Africa. But we kept delaying and doing some skirmishes in Africa, just wasting time. That's what we were doing, wasting time. And eventually, we did the Operation Sicily when we invaded Sicily, and we took it very quickly. And then from once we had a foothold in the Italian, Sicily is an island, but off the peninsula, Italian peninsula. But once we had a foothold in Italy, in the form of Sicily, that taking and Italy collapsed on its own. It's like the people of Italy were just waiting for the excuse to take out Mussolini, and Mussolini was gone, and he had to flee. And we had captured him, or he was captured, but he, as we mentioned before, he was able to escape and take refuge in the north, and with the help of the Nazis, he set up a very like a puppet regime in the north of Italy, the Socialist Italian Republic of Italy, and socialist, which goes with fascism, as we tried to explain before. So in this one, upper third of Italy, there was this puppet regime, quote, run by Mussolini, even though he was more of a puppet, a figurehead for the Nazis. And but then the rest of Italy just gave way on its own, and we were free to be in Italy, at least in the lower two-thirds of it. And we could have just said, okay, we're in Europe now, we're in continental Europe, let's go up and kick butt. And we had Africa, enough of Africa to not be interfered with. We had Sicily, we had the lower half of Italy, lower two-thirds of Italy. All we had to do is just go up, just go into the heart of the beast. Just as Churchill kept saying to FDR, please, let's do that. Because as Churchill, as we explained before, was concerned that if we just let things be, and the Soviets start winning against the Nazis, what they're going to do is replace the Nazi dictatorship with Soviet dictatorship, just replace one oppressor with another. And he didn't want Eastern Europe to fall to the Soviet Union. So going into the heart of Europe was a way of, battling the Nazis and then kind of going into Eastern Europe and liberating that part of Europe before the Soviets, quote, liberated it. And obviously that was in quotes, because after they, quote, liberated Eastern Europe, it became enslaved under the Soviets for 40, 5 years, more or less, 44, 45 years. But we didn't do it. So June 6th is this symbol of our inaction. Oh, and by the way, I do believe we would still have done a Normandy invasion, but it would have been to open a second front for us, not for the Soviets, because we would have been fighting and engaging the Nazis head on. And taking that last third of Italy would have been easy if we had been committed to it, because Mussolini was a weakened leader. And the Italian people in the north were not that sympathetic to him. I mean, once the war ended, they hanged him. I mean, that's how happy they were. Even the communists were unhappy with him, and they were part of the people who took Mussolini and hung him and a whole bunch of other people. From what I remember, it was not just Mussolini that got hanged. So the Italian people were easy to convince to let go of Mussolini. So we would have had the support of the Italian people. We could have taken back all of Italy. Not easily, but, relatively easily. And once we had taken Italy, then we would have been able to spread into Eastern Europe or even go straight into Berlin or do a whole bunch of stuff and engage the Nazis. And as we were doing that, then we could have done an invasion from Normandy, because we would have been distracting them in the heart of Europe and then gone in like doing a sandwich on them and ended the war much more easily. But June 6th represents our foundation leading to inaction, which led to the enemy filling the void we never cared to fill. In other words, we as a country, conservative movement is a movement of inaction. It's just, preserving. It's preserving the old. And no need to change anything. If it ain't broke, don't fix it. Even if it's the underlying things are broken and are just a time bomb, and we need to correct it before it's too late, because the conservative just looks at the surface, out of sight, out of mind. If it doesn't seem to be decaying and it seems to be kind of working externally, why worry about it? Because the conservative, trapped in his practical mindset, can't see the metaphysical things, can't see the things that are moving behind the surface. That's the foundation of the country. It's a conservative foundation. And that foundation, which is kind of ironic, because when we are outside the realm of politics or philosophy or whatever, we are a very active people. I mean, this wouldn't be the greatest economy the world has ever seen if we were just a bunch of inactive people who never do anything. We're constantly innovating, constantly producing new things and trying new ideas and starting new companies. And it's a very dynamic, we're a very dynamic country and society. But then when it comes to the deeper foundational things, we're very, very pardon my French, it's like we don't give a damn. We don't care as a people about these foundational issues. It's as if it's irrelevant. And because we have no this foundation of inaction, then that allows the enemy, just like it did in Europe, to fill the void. The Soviets, if we're not going to liberate Eastern Europe because we don't care about it, because we don't want to act, then Eastern Europe is going to be filled with the Soviets. And that's what the Democrats have done. And they have taken over, everything, our culture, our politics, our everything, because of this foundation of inaction. As we constantly say, the old saying, nature abhors a vacuum. It's always a reality that if you leave a vacuum, someone will come and fill it up, fill it for you. And it's usually not a good agent that comes to fill that vacuum. So FDR did this inaction in during World War II on purpose. And he did it on purpose because, in his mind, first of all, he was more committed to fighting the non-whites, the Japs, as he would call them, and all the horrible things he did with the internment camps and all that, violating the human rights of American citizens who were of Japanese descent. He violated the human rights. The same son of a bitch would then talk about the need to add more human rights to our to the Constitution, talking about adding the right to a house, the right to this, all the socialist crap. But when it came to the actual rights of people, he couldn't have cared less about the rights of Japanese Americans, of Americans of Japanese descent. So he had a he was a racist, as we tried to explain before. So he had this inclination: if I'm going to fight somebody, let me fight the non-whites. But on the other side, his thought was, well, if the Soviet Union ends up, I want them to do the fighting, because if they succeed, they will conquer, Eastern Europe all the way up to Germany, and that's at the end of the day a good thing, because that means communism will arrive in Europe, and that's a good thing for the European people. That's what FDR thought. So if the Soviets end up taking over Eastern Europe, that's fine with me, because I'm a commie at heart. That's what FDR was thinking. He did it on purpose. But in our case, in a more general sense, in the country, conservatives are doing this inaction indirectly. And they do it, it manifests in so many ways. That's why I despise it when conservatives start criticizing the war in Iraq or the war in Ukraine. I remember when I was a kid, everybody said the Ukraine, and I would always say the Ukraine. I don't know why the has been dropped. I'm sure the Ukrainians don't say the Ukraine, but I'm just gonna go back to the old days and say the Ukraine, and I hope you don't mind. But the war in the Ukraine, it's criticized by conservatives because everything is, oh, we don't, the war machine and the Democrats and the neocons, and they start talking all this rubbish. And I go, my goodness, these sons of bitches don't understand that if you don't do anything, if you just let the world run crazy, that craziness is going to come back and bite you in the backside. Look at 9/11. We let things happen, and then eventually, boom, the attack came. So if we don't do anything, and just huddle up and pretend like the world doesn't exist, and we just care about America, and number one, first of all, by doing that, we kind of are betraying our responsibility that we've been given. To whom much is given, much is required of them. We have been given much. We have an influence on the world like no other country on earth, and that influence has also led to our increased prosperity, because that influence makes us wanted around the world. They want our products, they want everything, and that influence comes with a responsibility. Then you were put on this earth, America, as a beacon of freedom, as a beacon of light, of democracy, of truth and righteousness. That's why you were allowed to prosper. And if you don't act out on that, then you're going to get punished for that, because you are kind of, I'm trying to find the word, I forget the verb, but you are kind of reneging on your responsibility. And if you didn't want that responsibility, then you shouldn't have accepted the prosperity that comes with it. And these idiots, conservatives, don't realize if we had not had the war in Iraq, the terror, we would have had many 9/11s happen in this country. But because we took the war to them, and we took out a very evil man, Saddam Hussein, that was a blessing. We were given extra time I believe in my heart we were given extra time. All these men and women who fought and lost life and limb in Iraq did so not only to end the reign of Saddam Hussein. It gave us, you know, for those who use that terminology, it's like, just to explain it, it gave us, quote, karma points, for lack of an expression that, you know, it gave us the opportunity to restore this country. I believe we would have died with around the time of Latin America. Latin America died in 2003. The Iraq War happened in 2003. It's not a coincidence. And in fact, it should have happened in September. On September 18th of 2002, that's when the war in Iraq should have started. Between in the week of September 18th through September 24th, we were supposed to attack Iraq then, but Bush 43 decided to hold off. That was the time frame when we were supposed to go there. And he was about to do it, but he was waiting for someone to validate him. He went that's why he went on September 15th of 2002 to the UN. He came to New York and went to the UN and gave a speech on September 15th, 2002. It's like he was trying to gauge the crowd, the room, and say, does the room want, you know, what? How does the room, in this case, the world, you know, leaders, whatever, feel about me attacking this man? And he felt, you know, that there was no reception. And then he had the son of a bitch, Tony Blair, in his ear. And that convinced him to hold off for 6 months. And in those 6 months, Saddam Hussein was able to hide all his weapons of mass destruction, dismantle them and hide them, move them into Syria. And then a lot of those weapons and destruction were used during the Iraq War against Americans and against the Iraqi citizens. So the point is that when we finally went and liberated Iraq and took out this horrible dictator, that gave us karma points. And not only that, and I hate to use that term karma points, but I hope you see what I'm trying to say. And not only that, we started kind of taking it to the terrorists in their land or in their area. And if we had not done that, then they would have been focused on attacking us here in America. And so we not only gave ourselves more years, 20 years basically, to fix things, 20 years of opportunity to restore this country, we also saved ourselves from being attacked. So what seems like what's the point of us fighting in Iraq or Afghanistan? That's what conservatives don't see. They can't see beyond the surface. Everything is surface, surface, surface. If there's no immediate benefit or immediate results from something, they don't see any value in it, so they don't invest in it. And that's the inaction that has led to the current situation. So June 6th represented how we had a foundation that led to inaction. And conservatives have this mindset. They don't care about anyone else. They only care about what they see. And if it ain't broke, don't fix it. It's not my problem. If it's not a problem inside the borders of America, it's not my problem. Because America is number one. America is great. We have the greatest constitution in history, in the history of mankind, the greatest democratic system the world has ever seen, blah, 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 blah. And we keep deceiving ourselves with this mindset, very closed-minded mindset. That's the foundation of our country. And that goes with the judgment personality. As we've said before, there are five human personalities, basic human personalities. And there are two others, but they're like wild cards, you could say. But the five basic human personalities are the judge, visionary, conqueror, server, and organizer. And the judge personality is the one that lays foundations for things, because for judgments, you need wisdom. And wisdom is what serves as the foundation for everything you do. So we have been building on this foundation, a very faulty foundation made of very brittle wood that has been rotting and rotting, and now it's decaying and it's falling apart. And so June 6th, that is an indictment against our judgment personality that has embraced a wisdom that is not real, the wisdom of the founding fathers. So that's what June 6th represents of 2023. It's an indictment against the conservative foundation that we have, where our judgment personality has become distorted because it has decided to embrace the judgment personality of the country of America has decided to embrace a wisdom that is not real, the wisdom of the founding fathers. And then June 7th, we had the word, and as I shared before, it was not a coincidence that I was walking into this coffee place during my lunch break. They had the radio on and they were saying, June 7th of 2023 in New York was the day with the most toxic or unhealthy air since 1964. And 1964 is the year of the Civil Rights Act in America. And it was, as we said before, a symptom of or a kind of an indication of, okay, 1964, when we had this toxic air in New York, and I'm not sure why there might have been some other fires going on at that time. I have no idea. But the thing is, 1964, black people were set free, or beginning to be finally set free, something that had been waiting 100 years, because that's 99 years after the end of the Civil War, and black people were still being heavily oppressed because of inaction. It's the same thing. But so black people are finally being set free, and then the question is, what are you doing with that freedom? And in 2023, what they're doing with that freedom is going around smoking cannabis all over the place here in New York and sticking up the place with cannabis, the stench of cannabis. So it's just to say, this is what we're doing with our freedom. So I have been complaining constantly about the toxicity in the air of the cannabis. And it's as if the whole city was given a bit of a taste of what it feels like to be in an environment where you're not happy with the air around you. But it was also a figure of how black people have used their freedom. Instead of using it to be on the watchtower to see the times and discern the seasons, they have used it for stupidity. And ironically, you know, this toxic air that came from the wood burning in Canada made it very, very difficult for to see. Like you would take, you know, people were taking pictures of the New York skyline, and you could barely see the buildings in the distance. And when you go to the watchtower, you go up high to go see things that are coming at a distance. And on that day, you couldn't see anything. It was like as if to say, "Hey, this is what you black people, you have been fogging up your brain with all that cannabis." Figuratively and literally, and you're so, you know, so indulgent on your own, satisfying yourself and indulging yourself, that your vision is fogged up, and you were supposed to be on the watchtower telling America what was coming, and you didn't do it. And that has to do with the visionary personality. You know, the person who sees into the future and who tells people this is coming. And we didn't do that. So you could say, in a sense, that June 6th is kind of an indictment on the white side of America, and June 7th is an indictment on the black side of America. Our judgment personality being indicted on June 6th, and our visionary personality being indicted on June 7th. And then on June 8th, what happened was that, what's his name? Pat Robertson passed away, and at the same time, Donald Trump was indicted. And we kind of very briefly talked about Pat Robertson because we had already taken so long. Just as now, we've taken much longer than I expected to get to this point. But we wanted to share a few things about him that we didn't get to share the other day. So I'm going to read here from the Wikipedia page on him. And you always, Wikipedia is a good source when you can trust that there's not going to be any bias. Like if you go do a search on the second law of thermodynamics, you can trust it more or less. What you will read is accurate, or more or less on the nose, because who has a bias against the second law of thermodynamics? Or if you read about a news story from the past or a historical event, if there is no connection with Christianity or the Muslims, or a connection to something else or some political connection, you can more or less rely on it being objective, just telling you what happened. But as you start reading about the biography of people who have a political association or a quote religious association, then you have to watch out. You're going to read stuff, some facts mixed with opinion that is portrayed as fact. And let me just give you an example of that. It is so disgusting. The lack of what passes for objectivity, it is so disgusting. Let me see if I can find it here. I believe it's, where is it now that I need to find it? I can't see it. Let me see. Okay, here it is. Look at how they phrase this. As a commentator and minister, Robertson frequently generated controversy. And by the way, it's interesting, they always have controversy only when it's people from the right. People from the left also generate controversy, but because they agree with it, it's not controversial to them, hence it's not a controversy. That's how they view the world. So it says here, the divisive and dehumanizing nature of his comments resulted in some of his remarks becoming the subject of national and international media attention, prompting responses from politicians. And then there's a, just to supposedly make it objective, there's a footnote to a reference. And the reference is to a book written by a, I think it's a book written by some nut job liberal. So, but the what bothers me is it says, it should say, as a commentator and minister, Robertson, I mean, if you want to mention controversy, then you should say frequently generated controversy amongst people of a liberal or left-leaning point of view. Because it wasn't causing controversy to Christians, to many Christians or most conservatives. It was only controversial to the liberals. So they never say controversy amongst those of a liberal or left-leaning persuasion. Then it says the divisive and dehumanizing nature of his comments. So isn't that very like a very, it's a like an open declaration that he was divisive, he was dehumanizing. But it doesn't say the divide. Some portrayed him as divisive. Some liberals portray him or believe or see him as divisive and dehumanizing. That'd be a different, way of saying it, a more correct way of saying it. But they, so when you read a Wikipedia article on a biography on a person, always keep in mind, you're walking on a landmine. You just have to be sure not to fall for any of this stuff. You can kind of sift through the actual facts and kind of leave out the rest of the rubbish that they put in there. But what I wanted to share here is that his name, Pat Robertson's name, is not really Pat, which is interesting. His name was Marion, Gordon Robertson. And when I saw Marion Gordon Robertson, I said, oh yeah, I see why he changed it to Pat, because I wouldn't want to be called Marion, and no offense to anyone named Marion, but it turns out that his reason for changing it was the same as what came to my mind immediately. Let me read here. It says here, Marion Gordon Robertson was born on March 22nd, 1930, in Lexington, Virginia, into a prominent political family, the younger of two sons. His parents were Absalom Willis Robertson, a conservative Democratic senator, and I hate that, he was not a conservative, but whatever, a conservative Democratic senator, and Gladys Churchill, née Willis, a housewife and a musician. At a young age, Robertson was nicknamed Pat by his six-year-old brother, Willis Robertson Jr., who enjoyed patting him on the cheeks when he was a baby while saying, pat, pat, pat. Later, Robertson thought about which first name he would like people to use. He considered Marion to be effeminate and M. Gordon to be affected, so he opted for his childhood nickname, Pat. So in other words, his name, and the thing is, his father was a nasty fellow, I would dare say. He was a senator. He was the son of a U.S. senator, a Democrat, interestingly enough. But he was a racist. So he was, from that Southern Democrat racist bent. Always, the Democrat Party has always been the party of racism. Always. It still is. It will always be the party of racists. And ironically, those who claim to be anti-racist are the most racist people, the ones who are doing the most damage to people of all races. And we could go on that, but it doesn't matter anymore. The country's dead. So, and these people will never be convinced they are so stupid, incapable of understanding their own racism. They just don't get it. Because they are racist under the impression that they are anti-racist, and that's what that's why they're so trapped in that racism. They balkanize the country into races. They can't think of people as people, and the people that they want to help, they are constantly destroying. Look at Democrat-run cities where black education is constantly destroyed, and crime is pervasive, and black lives don't matter in Democrat-run cities. Black crime is through the roof, and their economies are in shambles. There's no concern about black people amongst Democrats and liberals. They don't care about black people, because if they cared about black people, every place run by Democrats would have black people prospering. And I have cared about black people my whole life. I have cared about them, as if I was black myself, and it hurts my heart to see how black America has destroyed itself. I was seeing the vision of the greatness that was inherent and possible in black America, and it was thrown away. And all these Democrat sons of bitches who claim to be anti-racist were a big part of destroying the greatness in black America. It is so angering. I digress. The thing is that it is, to me, not a coincidence that his father, who was this very legalistic, nasty fellow and a racist, gave him such an effeminate name. As we've said before, the root of homosexuality is, or one of the foundations that lead to homosexuality emerging, is extreme legalism. If you're in an environment that is very legalistic, it is very emasculating. It oppresses you and crushes your masculinity, and it gets to the point where it just opens the door for certain people who are very sensitive, or have a certain kind of personality to listen to to the voice, you could say, of homosexuality and believe it and embrace it. That is the root of that. And I'm sorry if I've said this before, I feel the need that we have to say it over and over again. And that's why that's why there's such a homosexuality problem in Catholicism, and because it, with Catholic priests and all that, because it's a very legalistic environment, and that leads to that open door for homosexuality. So the thing is that and homosexuality requires a mind that learns to obey orders. And you say, what do you mean? See, homosexuality requires embracing something that does not come naturally or biologically. So you have to be trained into accepting something that is not biologically natural. Your mind just gets bombarded. No, this is normal. This is okay. This is who you are. This is who you are. This is who you are. And you get bombarded with this thought over and over again until you accept it. Yes, that's who I am. And then you're trained. So you have to have a very legalistic or open to legalism to embrace homosexuality, because you have to be trained. You have to force yourself to accept something that you would normally not accept. It's like smoking. When people smoke for the first time, they start coughing. Why are they coughing? Because to the body, that's not a natural activity. But there's some sort of promise of some sort of satisfaction associated to it, and then people just keep puffing and puffing away until they force their body to accept it as a normal thing. In a kind of a similar way, that's what happens with homosexuality, with all this transsexualism. That's why, they keep reinforcing it over and over and over again. That's why you have the Homosexual Arrogance Month. Here in the U.S., the stupidity, the month of June has become the month of homosexual arrogance, where everybody has to be proud of men, of other people inserting their genital organs in the sphincters of other people. And we have to be proud of that. I mean, why do we have to care about that? I'm sorry for being graphic about that, but we're being told you have to be proud of that, and they have to be proud of that. Why? Why do they have to be reinforced constantly? Then they need to be proud of that, and the people who are not of that, who do not practice that, also have to be proud of them. Why every year, over and over and over again? If it's a natural thing for them, why do they need to be reinforced over and over again? Our people are it's not like where people are gathering people who behave homosexually, and putting them, dumping them into these holes and burning them, or putting them in gas chambers, and no, there's nothing, none of that. But the thing has to be promoted over and over again. It's because you have to train the mind to accept it. That's why they have this indoctrination with the transsexuals, in school with the little children, because they need to do it from an early age to train the mind to accept it as a normal thing. And so that's why it's not a coincidence that Pat Robertson's father gave him a name that's more of a feminine name. Marion, I believe, is more of a girl name than a boy's name. But he said at an early age, "I'm not going to accept that." It's like as if to say, "No, I know my father called me, named me Marion, but I'm not going to embrace that." So he rebelled against the legalism of his father and said, "I'm not going to be effeminized. I'm not going to emasculate my masculine personality." And therefore, when his brother basically gave him an out, by calling him Pat, 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 when he was patting him on the cheeks. I can just see that when he was 6 years old, having his older brother, you know, come with his two hands and patting him on the cheeks, pat, pat, pat. And he said, "Oh, there we go. That's my name, Pat." And to me, that's kind of a figure of him rejecting the matriarchy in some way, in some profound way, deep within his heart. He said, "I reject the matriarchy. I reject being ruled by feminine qualities." So that was very significant, I thought. And then the other thing that caught my attention that I wanted to share the other day is when I read the biography. I was shocked that it says here, when he was 11, Robertson was enrolled in the preparatory McDonough School outside Baltimore, Maryland. When I read that, I said, "Oh my goodness!" And that hit me very personally because I attended a school in Baltimore. I had the opportunity, the blessing of attending a school in Baltimore, and I'm not going to mention it by name, but I remember every year, you know, there was this big football game against McDonough School, and it was our school's biggest rival. And I think our school has played against them like 100 times since 1900 something, and at least our school has won like 60% of the games from what I saw online the other day. I would never stay to watch the games, but I always knew, oh, McDonough is coming to the school to play against us, and they were our biggest rival. So from a young age, I knew McDonough School. I had never stepped foot in McDonough School, but I knew about it because of the big football game. We would play against them every year. So it's interesting. He lived in the Baltimore area when he was a kid, and I grew up in the Baltimore area. So I don't know. It just felt strange. And then it says here, it's worth mentioning, in 1948, the draft was reinstated, and Robertson was given the option of joining the Marine Corps or being drafted into the Army. He opted for the Marine Corps. Robertson described his military service as follows: "We did long, grueling marches to toughen the men, plus refresher training in firearms and bayonet combat." In the same year, he transferred to Korea. "I ended up at the headquarters command of the 1st Marine Division," says Robertson. The division was in combat in the hot and dusty, then bitterly cold portion of North Korea, just above the 38th parallel, later identified as the Punch Bowl in Heartbreak Ridge, unquote. For Robertson's service in the Korean War, he was awarded 3 battle stars. So he fought in the war. He fought in the Korean War, and served in the army, in the military. And it says here that in 1986, a former Republican Congressman Paul Pete McCloskey Jr., who served with Robertson in Camp Pendleton, wrote a public letter challenging Robertson's record in the military. Robertson filed a libel suit against McCloskey, but he dropped the case in 1988 in order to devote, quote, his full time and energies towards the successful attainment of the Republican nomination for the President of the United States, because he ran for president in 1988. But I wanted to mention this, that he was maligned, you know, and by a guy with a Celtic surname, McCloskey, you know, Scottish, Irish kind of origins of a surname. And there's always this thing with the Celtic people here in America, this constant betrayal, stabbing people in the back. And this guy was a Republican, and he was trying to stab a fellow or a person who was in the Republican Party, and trying to stab him and destroy him, smear him. So then it says here that so Robertson was promoted to first lieutenant in 1952. Upon his return to the U.S., he then went on to receive a law degree from Yale Law School in 1955. So he graduated from Yale. It says here, near the top of his class. However, he failed his first and only attempt at the New York bar exam necessary for admission, to the New York State Bar Association, which did not deter Robertson because he never intended to practice law anyway. Shortly thereafter, he underwent a religious conversion and decided against pursuing a career in business. So it's important, you know, some people, when he died, started like rejoicing, saying, oh, the grifter and the religious grifter, blah, 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 has died. Oh, how awesome. The gates of hell are welcoming the new guy. It's just nasty stuff. But he was not a person obsessed with greed. Otherwise, he would have said that, you know, what better place for a greedy person to be at than, you know, to be in the lawyer profession. But he wasn't interested. He had a sincere conversion. He said, no, I'm going to pursue higher things. And he attended the Biblical Seminary in New York, where he received a Master of Divinity degree in 1959. So interesting. So he lived for a while in Baltimore, where I grew up, went to a school that was the rival of my school, of the school I attended. And then he ended up kind of apparently living in New York, where I have lived as well, and where I'm, you know, living now in the New York area. So there seems to be some sort of like connection there. I don't know why. And also it says here, he became a born-again Christian while having dinner at a restaurant in Philadelphia with author and World War II veteran Cornelius Vanderbreggen. After his conversion, Robertson left the corporate world and went into the ministry. So interesting, Philadelphia comes into play again here. So I know this is not a coincidence. He became a Christian in Philadelphia, and then we have the bridge collapsing in Philadelphia. It says here, in 1956, Robertson met Dutch missionary Cornelius Vanderbreggen, who impressed Robertson both with his lifestyle and his message. Vanderbreggen quoted Proverbs 3:5-6, "Trust in the Lord with all thine heart, and lean not unto thine own understanding. In all thy ways acknowledge him, and he shall direct thy paths," which Robertson considered being the, quote, guiding principle of his life. He was ordained as a minister of the Southern Baptist Convention in 1961. I think we briefly mentioned this before, that Robertson his life was based on the idea that don't trust first impressions. That's kind of part of what this verse refers to. You know, trust, lean not unto thine own understanding. In other words, don't just accept something on the surface and just react to it in your own natural way. Like, when you start living by these words, you start living by a higher, like, awareness. No, there's more to things than meets the eye. And sometimes the quote, obvious solution is not the actual solution. Because there are invisible things that you're not seeing, and then you have to wait to see them. You have to, like, stay there and observe, and then you start seeing things that you had not noticed before. Because you just didn't arrogantly assume, I know the right solution. I'll just lean on my own understanding and carry it out. And that's what conservatives do all the time. That's what's so disgusting about them. I mean, liberals do that too. But they're crazy, so they're nut jobs. They're animals, they're inferior subhumans, they don't count. But when I look at conservatives, it's like, you know, you have a chance of being a human. The liberal has already given up that. He's given up his humanity. But you still have a chance to be a human, yet you don't embrace it because you keep leaning on your own understanding. Oh, the Founding Fathers, the Second Amendment, and the Constitution, and America number one, America number one, and anything that's not American or non-American or doesn't sound like it's glorifying our Founding Fathers and our flag, it is wrong. And this very closed-minded understanding. And it's not closed-minded in the sense of oh, you have to embrace homosexuality and you have to embrace transvestites. It's not, it's opening yourself to the truth, for crying out loud. You don't have the truth. But you keep leaning on that understanding, the very stupid, limited understanding that you have. That's why you never grow. But, well, Pat Robertson made an effort. He wasn't successful all the time, but many times he wasn't at all. But he was making an effort. He was, even when he chose the name Pat, it was like this breaking away from the legacy or whatever his father was trying to leave in his heart. And he was a Southern Baptist, but even as a Southern Baptist, he embraced Pentecostal ideas. He believed in miracles. He believed in the gifts, you know, Pentecostal gifts and stuff like that, which is, as far as I understand, something that Southern Baptists don't embrace. They are very traditional. It's a very limited, you know, very traditional religious view of the world. But he, even though he had the name of Southern Baptist, he did things that Southern Baptists would never do, or believed or embraced ideas that Southern Baptists would never do. So he was always this guy who was not just comfortable just being stuck in, following everything everybody was doing. So in a sense, he was not a conservative from that perspective. He was not like the rest of the quote conservatives. And not that, you know, he did and said many things that I wouldn't agree with, but what I'm trying to get is his heart was leaning towards the right direction. Even if he didn't get there fully, he was leaning in that direction. And it says here, in 1960, Robertson established the Christian Broadcasting Network in Virginia Beach, Virginia, by buying the license of a defunct UHF station in nearby Portsmouth. And notice the word defunct, because I think I mentioned that word when talking about Aramingo County, the same word, defunct. So because America's going defunct, and there was this chance for us to take the defunct UHF station and turn it into something new, but we chose not to, so it's not going to happen. But he bought this station, and the station with the call sign WYAH TV. And that's kind of interesting, because when I saw YAH, I said Yah. And that's kind of a short name that Jewish people sometimes use, or in Hebrew, to refer to God, Yahweh. So interesting that the call signs were WYAH, W Yah. First broadcast on October 1st, 1961. But I did want to mention, I don't know where to find this, but he did say at some point that, or the article here said at some point that when he and his wife lived in New York for a time, they were dirt poor, and they had to live in this roach infested apparently apartment in Bedford Stuyvesant or something like that, and. So they went through rough times here in New York. So, and then he rose to prominence, and so he was a person who was willing to embark on big challenges and achieve and conquer. So out of nowhere, you know, he established this broadcasting station by buying this license from this defunct station, And it says here, on April 29th, 1977, CBN launched a religious cable network, the CBN Satellite Service, which eventually became the Family Channel. So the Family Channel started as part of what this Pat Robertson was doing. It was eventually sold, I think, to, I forget to whom, and then they sold it to Disney, and then it was sold back to someone else or something like that. But the Family Channel actually started with Pat Robertson. So it was the first satellite television channel in America to connect to cable systems across the country. The venture became so lucrative that it could not continue to be part of a tax-exempt charity, so Robertson spun off the Family Channel as a commercial entity that was sold to News Corporation for $1.9 billion in 1997. So the thing is that he had this big vision, and even when he started with big poverty, he's had this clarity. Oh, I'm going to buy this station, and he was, he got into the flow of the cable thing before it became popular, and that's how he grew. So, what you see when you read about him is that he was a conqueror, a person who could take on a big city and conquer it. So he points to the conqueror personality, and also, you know, this thing about him not listening to what people normally around him believe. And I'm just going to mention one thing where I disagree very strongly, but, you know, it just shows that character in him, that he was not just going to do, he wasn't going to the conservative bookstore and say, hey, can you give me the manual for how to be a conservative, you know, and then take it and go home and read it. Okay, to be a conservative, you have to believe this, believe that, believe the other. Okay, and memorize. Okay, I have to believe this, I have to believe that, because otherwise I'm not a conservative. He was never like that, because he never tried to lean on his own understanding. So it says here, Robertson repeatedly called for the legalization of cannabis, saying that it should be treated in a manner analogous to the regulation of alcoholic beverages and tobacco. Robertson stated that, I just think it's shocking how many of these young people wind up in prison and they get turned into hardcore criminals because they had a possession of a very small amount of controlled substance. The whole thing is crazy, unquote. In 2014, he turned against the legalization of cannabis. So for a while, Robertson was saying the opposite of what you would ever expect a conservative to say. He was for the legalization of cannabis, as you may know if you hear these audio snippets regularly. I'm opposed to it because look at the disaster it has caused. But the thing is that he was for it. And it's interesting when he starts talking about the young people wind up in prison and they get turned into hardcore criminals. So he's going in the direction of the things we have talked about in these audio recordings. It's like he's aware, okay, the prison system, there's something wrong with it, because instead of being a place where people have have time to think about what they've done and decide to change their lives, it becomes this criminal school. It's like going to criminal college. You criminal university. You go there and you learn how to, I'm shocked when I see these scenes of prisons and you see them playing basketball. I go, what the hell are they doing playing basketball inside a prison? Like, I'm sorry. It should be a place of isolation. It's a place of sorrow. That's what it should be. Not that they should be tortured and whipped every day. That's not what I'm saying. Just be left in a small room, and that's where they will be. And the room has enough for them. They have a toilet, a toilet there, and they can take a shower in there, and they have a desk and a bed. They sit there, and they can maybe even have a computer, a very simple computer there. And have access to the internet, very limited, and be able to study. And that's all. And they have, you know, certain hours of internet, and they can access these limited websites and maybe study to get their high school diploma or study online or just sit there and wait and basically not interact with anyone. Other than the people that, put the food through some slot on the door or whatever. And that would be it. And no communication with other criminals. So what I'm trying to say is that he was kind of like beginning to go there. And in his mind, he was concerned about these young people. So being a conservative, you would think, oh, I don't care about all these criminals, you know, they can rot in jail for all I care. I don't like cannabis, so that should just rot in jail. He wasn't thinking like that. he had compassion. He was trying to understand, how to solve the problem. He just had the wrong solution for it, but he was going there. That's what I'm trying to say. And then eventually he realized he was that it was nonsense to endorse the legalization of cannabis. So he did have a change of heart. So he was not like hard-coded, oh, I'm going to believe this and this is it because this is the truth. He found out that it wasn't true, and he was willing to change. So that openness to the truth, he had it. He was not like all the other conservatives, even if he sometimes sounded like one. He was not like all of them. And the fact that he died on that day is the day that represents the dying of people like that in the quote conservative movement in America. And it's a death, like a symbol of the death of the conqueror personality, the personality that would have taken the truth and gone out to conquer America and the world, to conquer it for the truth. The people who had the resources, who had the potential to do that, they're gone. They're dead. And that's what Pat Robertson's death symbolizes. And I wanted to read very quickly, the influence. That's why it was so shocking to me how little attention all these son of, sorry, pardon my French, sons of bitches conservatives, all the little attention that these sons of bitches gave to Pat Robertson's passing. And they were all concerned about Trump. It's like they got all distracted by Trump's indictment. And I would say that even if Trump had not been indicted, that they would have not really paid that much attention to Pat Robertson. But they have their little hero, Trump, unlike what Tina Turner would have said, they keep saying we need another hero. And Trump is their hero right now, and Trump was being indicted, and they were all concerned about that the day that Pat Robertson died. And it says here, I'm reading from ABC News, a liberal, site. It says here, this story, this is when, well, this was on June 9th in the early morning hours, so the day after Pat Robertson had passed away. It says, Pat Robertson united tens of millions of evangelical Christians through the power of television and pushed them in a far more conservative direction with the personal touch of a folksy minister. His biggest impact may have been wedding evangelical Christianity to the Republican Party to an extent once unimaginable. Now he was so what they're trying to say here, and it is real. He was a big part of telling Christians, or the conservative Christian, don't just live in your world and in your church and think that everything's going to be okay as long as you're, hunkering down, in your little conservative Christian church bunker. There's a world out there that we have to conquer. That's what he was saying. He had the conquering personality. There's a world out there we have to conquer. That's what he was telling his fellow Christians. And it says here, the culture war is being waged today by just about all the national Republican candidates. That's partly a product of Robertson, unquote. Now, that's a bit of an exaggeration, said veteran political analyst Larry Sabato, director of the University of Virginia Center for Politics. I say an exaggeration because most Republicans are not really waging a culture war. I mean, most Republicans are, soft compromise sons of bitches and whores. So that's why I mean an exaggeration. But Robertson did have a big part in the few in having a few Republicans do the culture war thingy. And Cecily Robertson died Thursday at the age of 93. And I thought it was 83, and I misspoke the other day. I don't know why I was thinking 83, but he was actually 93. And I think that means something, but we'll leave it at that. And I guess in a sense, because eight is the number of regeneration, so he was like that eight that was missing from, if you recall, we talked about 79. So he had that element of regeneration in him. He just never developed it, unfortunately, to the point that, and that's why I was sharing that. I know that I could see him, sobbing, saying, I wish I'd known, I wish I'd known, because he was being told all these things that he didn't know, things in these audio recordings. Yeah, maybe not citing, I don't know, if citing, you know, the actual audio recordings, like, oh, these audio recordings you should have listened to, but the concepts, at least, that's for sure. I know he was, who knows, maybe he was being told about the website where these audio recordings are posted or whatever. But the things, he was being told all these things that he should have known, and he was sobbing, saying, I wish I'd known. Unlike other conservatives who are just going to complain and say, no, that can't be true, because my conservatism is the truth. So the thing is that it says here, Robertson's reach exploded with the rise of cable in the late 70s. He galvanized many viewers into a political force when he unsuccessfully ran for president in 1988. The next year, he created the deeply influential Christian Coalition. He sought to influence and impact the trajectory of the Republican Party and turn it into a pro-life, pro-family party, said Ralph Reed, who ran the coalition in the 1990s and now chairs the Faith and Freedom Coalition. The Christian Coalition helped fuel the Republican Revolution of 1994, which saw the GOP take control of the U.S. House and Senate following the 1992 election of President Bill Clinton. And, you know, and the Revolution of 94 was very important, very important. It showed that, you know, we could change things very quickly. We got into budget surpluses. Believe it or not, we had a brief period of budget surpluses in America. We were going to go out of debt. The cycle of this constant spending was being stopped, and there were changes happening. The contract with America, that is part of the things that would have happened in the new American constitutional system, where we have spoken about this before in other audio snippets, where the candidates have to make or can make promises to the people and say, I promise if I get elected, I will do this, this, and this. And then they can be held even criminally liable if they don't fulfill the promise. In other words, if you're going to walk the walk, if you're going to talk the talk, you'll have to walk the walk. And if you're going to promise you're going to do this, and if you don't do it, the population would have the opportunity to make a vote. Maybe online, it doesn't have to be a formal, going to a poll kind of thing. But if a candidate decides, no, I can't fulfill this promise because circumstances have changed, then the American people can let him off the hook and say, through a vote, say, okay, we'll let you break this promise. And, but he would be held accountable. Like, for example, when the idiot Trump kept saying, lock Hillary up, we'll lock her up. I'll lock her up when I get to be president. And then he got to be president, and he didn't lock her up, didn't lock Hillary Clinton up. So what I'm saying is, the contract with America, which was part of the Republican Revolution of 1994 with Newt Gingrich, it was this thing where the candidates said, if you elect us, we promise you we're going to do this, 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 and this, very specific. And people said, oh, I like that. They voted for them, and they went and did it. I'm not sure if they did everything, but I think that for the most part, from what I recall, I was kind of young then, not paying too much attention, but I think they did enough to basically say they did fulfill more or less the contract with America that they had made. And that led to a lot of changes. And then, the budget surpluses disappeared. And then now we have $35 trillion in national debt. That's going to be part of the collapse of this country, once it dies. That's going to be one of the big reasons it just goes into third world putrid status, just like Argentina right now. They feel so proud that they have, quote, won the World Cup. We have talked about that in previous audio snippets, but that World Cup is fake. The World Cup ended at the end of overtime, as we said before. There shall be no more World Cups. It's done. It's over. And what good has that, quote, World Cup, they, quote, won, done for them? If you go read the stories, I saw this picture of all these homeless people in some place in, I think, Buenos Aires or some place in Argentina. And they have rampant inflation. I mean, they have un rampant unemployment. It's c total collapse. And it's a judgment and a curse on them because of what happened in the World Cup. So, yeah, you wanted the World Cup. Now, here are the consequences. The judgment on you as a people. Disgusting. Disgusting people. And we're going to be like Argentina. And Argentina used to be one of the richest countries on earth. Many people don't realize this. I believe, I'm not mistaken, at the turn of the century, Argentina was one of the 5 or 10 richest countries in the world. And people don't know this, but they were wealthy and prosperous. And then they began this slow decline, and now they're gone, they're dead. And I think they died as a country sometime between 2009 and 2014. I don't remember exactly at what point, but at some point between those two periods, they died because they died after the rest of Latin America. Latin America, except for three countries, died in 2003. Then Argentina died somewhere between 2009 and 2014. And Uruguay died with them because Uruguay is like Argentina's twin brother, little brother. And Brazil is the only one that I'm not sure whether it is living or dead. It's the only one in the Americas that I'm not clear about. But the thing is that so Pat Robertson was very influential in the Republican Revolution of 94. And so he had a force, and this 94 period was a period of change, of radical, of fundamental change. Not enough to rescue the nation. It wasn't, going at the levels that needed to be done, but it was a start. And he was influential in this movement. There's a reason for that, because he was an agent of change, of transformational change. He never fully developed it, but it was there. He was not a racist, so he kind of he was the opposite of his father. So he was never just going to follow a script. He was going to do what he believed was right. And he as we shared before, he actually endorsed Rudy Giuliani, I believe, in I forget what year it was, but he endorsed Giuliani when everybody else was endorsing Bush 43. What I mean by that is that even though I wouldn't agree with that decision, I think basically it was showing him his independence. He was willing to think by himself, even if he didn't land on the right, exactly the right solution. There was one time, it says here, and they say it as a derisive thing, he claimed to have participated in prayer to keep a hurricane away from its Virginia base. So there was one time a hurricane was approaching, and he prayed, and the hurricane was kept away. And then some moron here wrote, quote, "Even Pentecostals, and I've known a lot, they are not usually going to go that far," unquote, said Grant Wacker. Moron emeritus, well, actually a professor, but moron emeritus of Christian history at Duke Divinity School. And why is he a moron? Because, I mean, if you're going to be a professor emeritus of Christian history at Duke Divinity School, I mean, you would think that, I mean, you would think, okay, he's a Christian, so you're going to be consistent with your own Christianity. If you believe in Christianity, then you believe in the God of the Bible. The God of the Bible is a God of miracles, of supernatural things where it talks about people praying to this God and things happening. If you don't believe any of that, if you think that all of that is nonsense, then what, pardon my French, what the hell are you doing teaching Christianity at a divinity school? See what I'm trying to say? Either you are here or you're not here. You can't have it both ways. And these sons of bitches, these morons, just keep living in this ambivalence. It's just annoying like hell, annoying. But at least, and what I'm trying to say with this also is that being a Southern Baptist, he was willing to pray for these things, you know, things that a Southern Baptist would never even dare to believe are possible. So he was a different person. And the thing is that So I think that's more or less what we wanted to say about him, and all of his life is kind of an example of how he. I did want to mention one thing. Two more things. He made a deal at some point with GNC, a health store here in America. I'm not sure how international it is, but it's a nationwide kind of health nutrition kind of store. And he made a deal to sell certain products and stuff. And the reason why I'm pointing that out is that he was a businessman. And a businessman who's venturing into new things, and he had this recipe or this health recipe that he was promoting in his Christian broadcasting network, some sort of I forget what it was, but he made a deal with GNC, and then apparently the deal was not completed because all these left wingers began to protest. Oh, you know, GNC is making a deal with Pat Robertson, because that's how they are. You know, they everyone who does not agree with the leftists is destroyed. I mean, that's what you do. You smear, you attack, you all this to destroy people who don't agree with you. So, but what I'm trying to say is he was always thinking outside the box, and he was a businessman, just thinking of new ideas, new territories to conquer. And business people who are very successful are conquerors, are evangelists. So there's the contrast of Trump being indicted that same day too. Trump is a conqueror. He has a conqueror personality. But you know, as you know, he, from what we've shared in these audio snippets, he's gone. You know, he's lost. And that same day that Pat Robertson said, "Okay, I'm packing my bags and leaving." On that same day, the conqueror Trump is being indicted. The one who was supposed to end the deep state, whatever that means. And I do believe there is that. I don't like the term because it refers to other things that are, I don't know, there's something wrong with the term. There's something beyond that term that bothers me. But I do believe there's something like that. I'm digressing. The thing is that he was supposed to destroy the deep state, and look at him. Look at him. He's being indicted by the deep state. He got kicked out of the White House through fraudulent elections. He got duped and manipulated, and you know, he got convinced into destroying the economic production he had started, productivity that he had started. You know, so he's a failure, the conqueror personality being exposed as a failure. Yes, I know the indictments are bogus. I understand that. But what I'm trying to say is he was unable to defeat the system that he claimed to, that he would be able to defeat. He got duped by the same system that is destroying him now. On that same day, it's like that it's as if the truth was saying, "Hey, here is your conqueror. Here's your conqueror for you." You know, it's like all bound up and chained and demoted, a failure, ostracized outside the city with no power to reconquer the city. And so that's what the eighth represent. The sixth was showing the death of the judgment personality. Because we're building on a wood foundation and the fire's coming and burning it up. And the seventh is the death of the visionary personality. Black people who were supposed to be on the watchtower, looking out, seeing things coming and telling us, are too busy, figuratively, literally speaking, smoking cannabis, and indulging themselves, and instead of having a clear vision of the horizon, they're fogging everything up with their cannabis, figuratively and literally. And that's the death of the American visionary personality. And then June the 8th is the death of the conqueror personality. The people who would have had the opportunity to conquer, they're not being allowed to grow and conquer. And so they are just moving on. And as a result, all the conquerors left behind are just failure conquerors. That's the death of the conqueror personality. Each day represents the day of the of a death, or an indictment or death of each of the three what we call male personalities, because judge, visionary, and conqueror are male personalities, and server and organizer are female qualities. Doesn't mean that you're a woman if you're a server. I'm not saying that, but it has a more feminine touch to it. Same as organizer. Women are more organized. I mean, everybody knows that. Women are much better at organizing and having everything, you know, tight, neatly grouped and everything. So it's a more feminine quality. But the male qualities have been judged, and then 3 days later we have the bridge collapse, as a confirmation of that. We wanted to talk about some other things, but I think this audio clip went way longer than I expected. Oh, one final thing, I was reading in that audio in that Wikipedia bio that. That Pat Robertson fell off a horse apparently and injured himself on August 11th of 2017, and that's very significant. And I guess we won't have time to explain why, but I believe that, and hopefully if we have the opportunity, we'll talk in the next audio snippet about a certain event that's coming in 2024, that's related to something that happened in 2017, that happened around the time when he fell off his horse and injured himself. But we'll talk about that in the next audio snippet. And I hope that these words that have been shared have added some understanding to those 3 days and to the overall view of why America is collapsing as a country. And it's less than 3 months away, I would say, or 3 months around, 3 months from dying and becoming nothing more than a third world country. Thank you very much for listening.